It's the NPR News Update for Monday, August 3rd. Good day. I'm Phil Picardi with the Minnesota News Podcast. A reminder, starting Thursday, this podcast is changing. You will now be able to get the latest hourly newscast from NPR News in this podcast. And if you want all of the news from our reporters and hosts, subscribe to our new podcast, The Ticker, on iTunes or at nprnews.org/podcasts. Now for today's news. Mille Lacs is closing to walleye fishing tonight at 10 o'clock. The move by the Department of Natural Resources comes as the lake's walleye population has dropped to a 30-year low. Matt Sepik reports.
DNR surveys show plenty of young walleye in Mille Lacs, but biologists say the fish have not been surviving to adulthood. In addition, DNR Commissioner Tom Landwehr says high catch rates and high mortality in July put this year's catch 2,000 pounds past the annual allotment.
It was really a set of unprecedented circumstances in that first 2 weeks of July that pushed us dramatically outside of our predicted harvest.
Governor Dayton is considering calling a special legislative session designed to aid resorts and other businesses near Mille Lacs. Matt Sepik, Minnesota Public Radio News.
The Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe says it will not net walleye on Lake Mille Lacs starting next spring. The surprising news came just before a town hall meeting last Friday that Governor Dayton held in Isle. Dan Crocker reported Friday for All Things Considered.
Hundreds of people packed the gymnasium at Isle High School for the hour-long meeting with the governor. Dayton told them he spoke to Mille Lacs Band Chief Executive Melanie Benjamin just before the meeting.
She consulted with her tribal elders this morning, and they are prepared to agree to forego any netting on the lake next year.
The crowd stood and roared its approval. The U.S. Supreme Court has upheld the treaty rights of Mille Lacs and seven other Ojibwe bands to harvest walleye from the lake during the spring spawning season, but the practice has long been controversial. Speaking to NPR News just before the governor's meeting, Benjamin said the band cares about the lake.
It's a huge sacrifice, but we're willing to do that because we are concerned about the health of that fish.
Benjamin says the band decided to give up its allotment next year despite what she called negative feelings from local people, including state legislators and county officials.
Leech Lake went through this, Red Lake went through this, and each one of those lakes rebounded. So it's time to take care of this lake. And what we can do in steps, we're going to do as well.
The band will still conduct some ceremonial netting next year to provide walleye for important cultural events. After the town hall, Dayton said Benjamin assured him she would try to convince the other seven bands to also give up their walleye allocation next year. Mille Lacs has been described as the world's largest natural walleye factory, but the fish's population is at a 30-year low. The Department of Natural Resources is adamant tribal netting is not to blame. DNR surveys show there are plenty of young walleye. The problem is they're not surviving to become big adults. The agency suspects a complex stew of invasive species and other factors changing the lake ecosystem are to blame. Still, frustration over tribal netting boiled over at the meeting with the governor. Here's longtime fishing guide Joe Felagy.
We are here because of the extremist and unacceptable workings of Mille Lacs Pacific Treaty Fisheries Management. Nutty hooking mortality assessment.
We're not going to go into the racist rants here. I'm not going to do it.
This has nothing to do with racism.
Well, then leave it out.
I am talking about state management and the program that victimizes these people.
Many resort owners and guides have sharply criticized DNR management of the walleye fishery. Despite tighter regulations they say have driven away tourists, the fishery has not rebounded. Karen McCoyd, owner of Max Twin Bay Resort, says the DNR has not listened to their input.
Our livelihood, but also our lives, our family heritages are here. You know, we don't want this fishery to collapse. If anything, we're more invested than anyone, not because of the business, but because this is our way of life.
Speaking after the meeting, Governor Dayton promised changes.
It's clear that we need a new team here. That you saw, there's zero trust, just absolutely no trust. People here with the DNR, who's their government. And when you've got that kind of complete catastrophic breakdown, there has to be changes.
Dayton said he supports DNR Commissioner Tom Landwehr, but said he'd change the team managing Mille Lacs. He's open to other possibilities, including stocking the lake with walleye, something DNR scientists have said would likely not work in Mille Lacs. He's also pushing for a special legislative session to provide economic relief to struggling business owners. But there is hope on the horizon. A record number of walleye were born in Mille Lacs in 2013. Those fish are still too small to keep, but guide Mike Verdea says the fishing this year has been phenomenal.
And the amazing part is you know, we're almost August. I've seen a lot of lakes and all over shut down completely by this time of the year, and they're still biting here. And it's not because they're starving. I mean, these fish are fat. Everything is. These little 14-inchers have little bellies on them.
Dan Crocker, Minnesota Public Radio News, Isle.
Federal health officials are warning states about the potential for more meningitis outbreaks. The warning follows confirmation that a Minnesota man had the same deadly strain of meningitis that has caused outbreaks in Chicago and New York. Lorna Benson reports.
Minnesota health officials say the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is sending an alert to epidemiologists around the country. The agency is asking them to send laboratory specimens to the CDC for testing if they detect cases of invasive meningitis, in particular among men who have sex with men. Meningitis isn't typically associated with that demographic, known in health circles by the shorthand MSM. But the severe infection has hit big cities with large MSM populations and may now pose an ongoing outbreak risk. Multiple cases have been identified in Los Angeles, in addition to New York and Chicago. Infectious Disease Director at the Minnesota Department of Health, Chris Ehrsman, says the rare bacterial illness appears to be gaining a foothold in the MSM community.
You know, the outbreaks in New York were in 2013, so this has kind of been sort of there and smoldering for quite a while.
Meningococcal meningitis typically strikes infants, teens, and young adults. Some of its symptoms include fever, headache, and a stiff neck, but cases can be fatal. The bacteria spread through sharing a drink, coughing, kissing, or other close contact with oral or nasal secretions. That's partly why young people living in college or university dorms are at a higher risk of contracting the disease. The infection is more likely to be fatal or cause serious complications for someone with HIV, but the current outbreaks are not concentrated in that population. The illness can be treated effectively with antibiotics if caught early enough. Nick Vogenthaler is medical director of Hennepin County's Red Door Clinic and the Positive Care Center at Hennepin County Medical Center. He says the outbreak among men who have sex with men follows a somewhat different path than the usual meningitis transmission. He says the victims came in contact with one another in a more public setting.
You know, a bar or a party situation, it also can be transmitted through more close, intimate contact. That's true, but not sexually transmitted.
A meningitis vaccine can help prevent the spread of the disease, and state health officials are urging all men who have sex with men to get immunized. Vogenthaler says there are ample supplies of the vaccine at his clinics, and more patients are asking about it. But he says it will be more challenging to spread that message to high-risk individuals who are not currently getting medical care. Matt Toburin is Director of Public Policy and Prevention at the Minnesota AIDS Project. His organization is working with the State Health Department to reach out to the MSM community. He says his group is primarily relying on word of mouth and social media to talk about the meningitis outbreak.
We're letting folks know that this is very serious, that it's dangerous, and that it is important to get a vaccine, because otherwise it's just sort of not, you know, on the forefront of people's minds of something that they should be worrying about.
The State Health Department says in addition to drawing media attention to the outbreak, it has also placed informational ads on gay-oriented dating applications, such as Grindr, to recommend vaccination for meningitis. Lorna Benson, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A new study says insect diversity in farm fields in our region can reduce the need for pesticides. Pesticides are widely used on corn and bean fields in the region and often blamed for declines in valuable insects. The study shows that farmers may need to spend less on pesticides once we understand how biodiversity works in farm fields. Dan Gunderson reports.
Scientists examined insect diversity in cornfields on 53 eastern South Dakota farms. USDA scientist Jonathan Lundgren says when they counted all the different bugs, they found something interesting.
Crop fields that had a lot of biodiversity in them had fewer pests.
So even without pesticide use, the fields with a lot of different bugs had fewer of the bad bugs that damage crops. South Dakota State University economics professor Scott Foste analyzed the relationships among all those insects. He says this is among the first studies to actually quantify the importance of insect networks in a farm field.
It relationships among herbivores and predators that determines whether corn insect pests will be either controlled by the ecosystem, or if the ecosystem has been diminished, then that will allow the corn insect pest to thrive.
So it's not just how many insects are in the field, it's the connection between bugs that eat plants and bugs that eat other bugs. We don't know very much about insect diversity, says USDA researcher Lundgren, but understanding how insects network and what that means for pest control could change how farmers manage pests.
We often think about biodiversity as something that needs to be conserved someplace else, right? Maybe in the Brazilian rainforest or something. But biodiversity is really important close to home as well. The really sort of sexy part of this study is that now that we know that biodiversity is important, now we can design cropping systems where we have a lot of diversity to help reduce insecticide inputs or pesticide inputs in general.
Lundgren says recent trends in agriculture threaten biodiversity. Fewer crops are grown, and pesticide use has increased on major crops like corn and soybeans. Systemic insecticides are commonly used on those crops, even if there is no pest threat to the crop. The study authors estimate U.S. farmers spent $3.2 billion to control corn pests in 2013. Corn is the most intensively produced crop in North America, covering about 5% of land surface in the U.S. The scientists plan to expand this research to other crops to see if the same principle applies. They also hope to put a number to the economic benefits of insect diversity. Lundgren hopes this study will convince farmers to reconsider preventive insecticide use on crops.
Pesticides are best applied when you have a pest problem. Otherwise, it doesn't make economic sense to use a pesticide. And there's costs to those pesticides, both in terms of the bottom line of the farming operation, but also environmental costs.
Lundgren says reducing insecticide use, planting cover crops, and using less tillage on farmland all help build a healthy insect community. Dan Gunderson, Minnesota Public Radio News, Moorhead.
Wildlife officials in Zimbabwe have accused another U.S. doctor with illegally killing a lion with a bow and arrow. The accusation says the Pennsylvania oncologist killed the lion in April without approval and on land where hunting is not allowed. This comes after Bloomington, Minnesota dentist Walter Palmer was accused last week of illegally killing a beloved lion named Cecil. Cecil had a radio collar and was part of a research study in a protected area. That research was conducted by a team led by Professor David McDonald of the University of Oxford. McDonald spoke with Heather McElhattan, producer of our A Beautiful World program, about his research and the impact of the public outcry over Cecil's death.
Biologists doing this sort of work live an interesting sort of life because, of course, like almost everybody else, we have to spend a certain amount of time driving a desk and tapping away on a computer. But for the rest of our time, we live sort of outdoorsman, backwoodsman sort of lives. In Zimbabwe, working with my close friend and colleague Andy Loveridge, the sort of day in the field that we might have would involve using a four-wheel drive vehicle to drive on very muddy, rutted roads or off roads altogether to go and try and find a lion to, for example, answer a question about what it had been doing. Suppose that overnight the satellite tracking device had told us that the lion had suddenly become stationary. We would normally deduce that that means it had made a kill. We would be interested in knowing what species of prey it had killed, because that could help us understand the details of its lifestyle. So it's an interesting and unusual combination between skills that people have used for millennia of living in the wild and skills that depend on the most cutting edge of technologies.
And your institution does remarkable work in this field, but you've also struggled a lot with finances and keeping your research going. And it seems to me that Cecil's death, as tragic as it is, has also greatly increased people's awareness of the situation and their interest in protecting wildlife.
Well, let me comment on that because my heart is bursting with gratitude, quite honestly, and inspiration. It is, of course, clear that the start of this story involves an allegedly illegal act, and there is personal sadness that, you know, a lion that we knew a lot about and were, if I can put it this way, personal friends with, has ended up dead in this tragic way. But incredible good is coming out of it. For me, perhaps the most important good is the signal that is going around the world that starts with Cecil, goes on to lions, but transcends to, I think, wildlife, nature, the environment, where millions of people around the world are voicing the thought that they attach value to nature, that they attach value to wildlife. And I think this says that humanity, at a crucial moment in its history, is looking for ways in which it can live alongside nature, both because it treasures it, but also because it depends on it. So I think this is a much, much bigger story than its origins with Cecil the Lion. And I think it says something inspirational. And for us, many of these people have amazingly been making donations on wildcrew.org to fund our project. And only a few weeks ago, we were thinking, Andy Loveridge and myself, sadly, that we might have to close down our anti-poaching patrol because we couldn't afford to pay the salaries. That has been reversed as a consequence of this. And now we're looking at the possibility of expanding the project, spanning out of Zimbabwe into Botswana, possibly into Zambia, because, of course, the lions move oblivious of the national borders throughout this whole landscape.
I love how you put it, that your heart is bursting. Were you surprised by the global response?
Well, I am surprised. And I want to tell you, if I may, because I know you're speaking to me from Minnesota, and I know that Minnesota, in a sense, feels slightly bruised because it has a personal association with this whole episode, that amongst the wonderful people that have contacted us are quite a lot of Minnesotans. And I want to express my gratitude for that. And a story that I think captures just how remarkable the response has been is that we had an email a couple of days ago from somebody in Bloomington saying that he was concerned that the whole town was, in a sense, tarnished by the illegality of this act. And this person, I think his name was Ron Pluft, runs a pizza parlor, Topper's Pizzas. And he says he's organizing a fundraising effort to donate half of their profits during the day and so forth to lion conservation.
That is Professor David MacDonald of the University of Oxford. He spoke with Heather McElhattan, producer of A Beautiful World. And to clarify, the folks at Topper's Pizza in Bloomington say they plan to donate half of the money spent there this coming Saturday to Professor McDonald's Wildlife Conservation Research Unit, and the other half to Wisconsin Big Cat Rescue.
A son of Norway who came to the Midwest for college more than 25 years ago has been named Norway's top official in the upper Midwest. As Dwali Saikau Tau reports, he now serves the nearly 900,000 Minnesotans with Norwegian roots.
Ivan Hybarek is the new Consul General of the Honorary Norwegian Consulate in Minneapolis. In this role, he wants to tell the stories of Norwegian Americans.
A lot of people haven't necessarily heard and understood clearly who we are and what we do.
He was born outside of Norway's capital 44 years ago and came to the U.S. when he was just 18. Now he's the CEO of the fraternal insurance group Sons of Norway and Norway's top official in Minnesota. It's a humbling position, he says, because the first man to hold this honorary post was former Vice President Walter Mondale.
You know, I can't even put my name in that same sentence, not even on the same page. He's an incredible man that accomplished incredible things.
Mondale served for 2 years. Gary Gandrud, a local attorney who had lived in Norway for 2 decades, followed.
To stay relevant, you have to look at where can you meet those younger generations, whether they're the teens at 20 or 30 or 40 something.
That's what the Norwegian ambassador to the U.S., Kari Aas, is trying to do too. He was in Minnesota to welcome Hybarek and to meet with others who have Nordic roots.
These people, they want to maintain their relations to Norway. They want to go to visit Norway. There are 6 universities in the Midwest, some of them founded by Norwegians in the 18th century.
One of the ways he does this is to Skype with university students across the United States through a social media experiment called Virtual Ambassador Program. He talks to students about serious topics such as NATO, but also about food and modern Norwegian art.
We are linking now up with universities, and I'm making remarks being that on peace and reconciliation, Arctic or other issues. And then at the same time, these students, they are they are commenting or they are asking questions through the use of Twitter, either prior to, during, or after these programs. And that is working. That is working.
Over at Norway House, a new cultural space in South Minneapolis, operations director Jeff Mueller stands outside a bright blue building in what is now a mostly Somali neighborhood.
Many years ago, a century ago, this was the exact spot where Norwegian and other Scandinavian immigrants first settled in this region, along Cedar Riverside and also along Franklin Avenue.
There are some who still remember the saloons and flop houses that were around back in the 1950s into the 1970s. Now there are diverse ethnic bakeries and trendy eateries. When development is finished on this block, the Norway House is going to be part of a larger project to include an event center for 350 people, an upscale restaurant, the Norwegian Lutheran Memorial Church, and a genealogy center. This will become what Mueller calls the National Norwegian Center of America.
Right now we're looking at sometime in 2018, so we're about 2.5 years away from sticking a shovel in the ground for the event center.
The cost for the Norway House campus is about $13 million. The capital campaign is underway. Dwahli Saikautau, Minnesota Public Radio News, Minneapolis.
That's the NPR News Update for Monday. I'm Phil Picardi, back with the Tuesday news. And remember, starting Thursday, this podcast is changing. You will now be able to get the latest hourly newscast from NPR News in this podcast. And if you want all of the news from our reporters and hosts, you can subscribe to our new podcast called The Ticker, and you can find it on iTunes or at nprnews.org/podcasts.